Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the December NJEDA Board Meeting. At this time, all phone participants are in a listen-only mode. Please be advised today's meeting is being recorded. When the chairman opens the public comment portion of the meeting, the members of the public attending by phone will be advised to press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad to be placed in the queue to speak and provide comment. You will be asked to provide your name and any organization with which you are affiliated. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star and then 0. I would now like to turn the conference over to Chairman Terry O'Toole. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Operator. I'm going to call the meeting to order. Tim, do you want to read the Open Public Meeting Notice?
Good morning, Chairman. In accordance with the Open Public Meeting Act, notice this meeting has been sent to the Star-Ledger and the Times-Trenton at least 48 hours prior to this meeting, and a meeting notice has been posted on the Secretary of State's bulletin board at the Department of State.
Thank you, Tim. Manure, could you call the roll, please?
Yes. Chairman Terrence O'Toole.
Present.
Vice Chair Charles Farlow.
Here.
Phil LaLaggia.
Here.
Robert Shimko.
Here.
Jewel Antoine Johnson.
Present.
Virginia Bauer.
Here.
Fred Dumont.
Here.
Marcia Marley.
Here.
Aaron Truns from the executive branch.
Okay. Mayor, Mayor, Aaron will be calling in a little, he'll be a little late to the meeting.
Thank you, Tamara. Okay. Justin Zimmerman, Commissioner of Banking.
Present.
Chief White for Labor Commissioner Robert Angelo.
Here.
Elizabeth Dragon for DEP Commissioner Sean LaTourette.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Manura. I'd also ask for the public members on the phone. We've got two public members in the room, so as we go through the meeting, I'd encourage you to be not afraid to speak up with respect to proposing or seconding motions so we can move quickly and save the voices of our public members here. We have two sets of meeting minutes to approve today. The first before you, board members, are the minutes from the November 16th EDA board meeting for review and approval. I kindly request board members state their name for the record when making a motion or seconding. Thank you. Could I hear a motion to approve the November 2nd board meeting minutes?
Robert Shimko.
Thank you, Robert. A second?
Second.
A second.
Thank you, Jewel. Any further discussions? Hearing none. Sorry, was there a discussion or a question?
No, may have been a sneeze.
A sneeze. Hearing no questions, let's call a vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any recusals or abstentions? Any opposed? Hearing none, the minutes are approved. Also, we have before you the executive session meeting minutes from the November 16th meeting. Could I hear a motion to approve those minutes?
Jewel Antwine, motion to approve.
Thank you, Jewel, a second.
Dragon, second.
Thank you, Elizabeth. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the minutes are approved. We have a lot of items to consider today. It's our last meeting of the year. Let me briefly give you the chairman's remarks. One of the core elements of Governor Murphy's stronger and fairer economic plan is investing in New Jersey's communities. In support of that objective, the EDA has launched many initiatives designed to drive catalytic development in municipalities where it is needed most, and in ways that revitalize long-dormant properties, generate economic activity, foster arts and other initiatives that uplift our cities, and improve the quality of life for New Jersey families. So far, this has led to the launch and creation of the EDA programs like Aspire, the Historic Property Reinvestment Tax Credit, the Asset Activation Program, the 21st Century Redevelopment Planning Grant Program, and various brownfield initiatives. Additionally, this includes the Cannabis Equity Grant Program, also known as Joint Ventures. I have no role in coming up with these names, which was launched in April of this year. Under phase one of the program, the EDA has awarded $12 million to 48 startups, and phase two opened for applications just a few weeks ago. Aligned with Governor Murphy's Stronger and Fairer agenda, Joint Ventures was designed to enable entrepreneurs, particularly those from communities historically harmed by the war on drugs, to start and expand their cannabis businesses and eliminate longstanding barriers to entry for individuals harmed by racially biased marijuana arrests. The EDA's multifaceted approach to support the revitalization of communities also includes planning grants for the state's three government-restricted municipalities, namely Patterson, Trenton, and Atlantic City. Specifically, with respect to Atlantic City, alongside Newark and Asbury Park, hosted the inaugural North Shore Festival last June, featuring the best New Jersey has to offer in music, innovation, and the arts. It was highly successful. Plans are underway for an even more robust festival in the summer of 2024, and you'll hear about that today. Today, we will also continue with the EDA's work towards elevating our communities by seeking your approval of public space activation programs under the Activation, Revitalization, and Transformation, or ART, program. The ART program is designed to help local communities address the negative impact of the coronavirus pandemic by investing in projects that create the environment necessary to attract and retain residents and talent, to enable business creation and attraction, enhancing downtown vitality, and to help local governments avoid future budget crises. Today, the board will be asked to consider awards for three public space activation projects in Atlantic City and one in Newark. Projects are all located within a 1.5-mile radius of the New Jersey Transit Rail Station. If approved, each of these projects will receive grants ranging from $248,000 to $1.5 million. You will also be presented with a new program that will provide grants to support up to 50% of the costs of eligible catalytic capital projects in Atlantic City. Atlantic City continues to grapple with persistent economic challenges, including high unemployment rates, limited access to essentials such as quality food options, a shortage of Class A office space, and inability to access state initiatives available to other municipalities. This program will leverage $26 million of the $30 million in the American Rescue Plan funds designated for the Atlantic City initiatives. Switching to Aspire, building upon the success of our Aspire program, the board will be asked to approve two major projects today for Aspire tax credits. In Sayreville, the Riverton project consists of 2 million square feet of newly constructed residential and commercial space, including 1,300 new residential units, 20% of which will be designated as affordable. The project is associated with over $1 billion in private investment and will transform the vast dormant property as you come over the Driscoll Bridge on the parkway heading south into a bustling riverfront community. In Hoboken, the Hoboken Connect residential project will be a 27-story mixed-use new construction development at the current site of a New Jersey Transit parking lot. The project will help transform the area known as Hoboken Yard and offer nearly 400 residential units and over 1,200 square feet of retail space. With each Aspire approval, we continue to expand housing for New Jersey's families and to revitalize communities. Now let me turn it over to Tim for the CEO's report.
Thank you, Chairman. I'll try to be brief because we have a pretty robust agenda today, as we almost always do. But there's a lot going on. December and November are busy months, and this year's no exception. A couple things just to report on it covered in my written report. Kathleen, Elizabeth from the Film Commission team, Dan Bryan, who's Commissioner of the Film Commission, and Eric Brophy from the Governor's Office, and I are just back from a really great trip to California. Was that last week, Kathleen? That feels like it was a month ago already, but it was last week, Tuesday and Wednesday. We were in Los Angeles for a whirlwind trip through Hollywood, seeing lots of the big studios, having great meetings, all of which have had really good follow-ups and engagements ever since. You know, the timing was right with the ending of the strikes and the resolution of the labor disputes in a really good way for the writers and the actors, and also a moment to kind of reintroduce New Jersey, given some of the changes we made to the film tax credit program, the fact that we brought the Film Commission into the EDA family, in the last couple months, and so it was a really good moment to kind of, again, reintroduce New Jersey. And, you know, the opportunity that presents itself in film and TV is incredibly important and significant, and even in a market which is really challenged. So film, you know, the sort of the content curve was kind of growing exponentially of how many people could make how many shows and how many streaming services could come online. That growth period is probably over and at an inflection point to a flattening out, if not a little bit of a decline. Don't worry about this. There's still a lot of applications. Don't worry about it. But, you know, one of the theses, Governor Murphy and First Lady Tammy Murphy, who's been instrumental to our film strategy, have laid out is that we have an opportunity to take share, even in a down market, for places like Georgia that are, in particular, on the wrong side of history on any number of issues. Pick up a long list of places like Texas, Georgia, Florida, that are on the wrong side of history, whether it's on, you know, women's reproductive freedom, LGBTQ plus issues, immigration, gun safety, any number of issues. That matters in film and TV probably more than any other sector of the economy, or just as much as any other sector of the economy. And so the opportunity to take share, even in a flat or declining market, we think is a huge opportunity. When we talk about, you know, film studios that are under development at Fort Monmouth, in the South Ward of Newark, in Bayonne, lots of other places, again, this is a, there's no reason we can't be, you know, one of the great film locations in the country, if not the world. So really exciting stuff there. Another thing, quick update. In October, this board approved $5.5 million of funding to support food security in Atlantic City. The governor, after some setbacks on the long-term vision to build a grocery store, gave us a pretty strong set of marching orders of do something right away as fast as humanly possible and impactful. And as of a week or two ago, a couple of those initiatives already launched. Virtua is running a twice weekly, will be actually twice weekly right now, it's once weekly, mobile grocery store to provide fresh, healthy food that's affordable as well to residents in Atlantic City. So there are folks, because of the actions of this board and the great work of our team, in this case led by Tara Colton, our Chief Economic Security Officer, newly minted title, by the way, there's folks eating and accessing fresh, healthy, affordable food in Atlantic City that didn't, in their neighborhoods, in their communities today, that weren't there, that those options weren't there 2 months ago. By no means mission accomplished. The food security challenge in Atlantic City and lots of other places remains pernicious and unacceptable, but, you know, making a dent in it and keeping our eyes focused both on the short term, the immediate term, and the long term. A couple of the quick things we announced, I was able to join Commissioner Saroangelo up in Newark. Congresswoman Cheryl was there as well, to announce $10 million of funding that the Department of Labor is actually going to provide to us, MOU coming to a theater near you soon, to actually accept that funding, but to build and support, really as part of a broader partnership around workforce development and economic development. Particularly that $10 million is focused on building or expanding registered apprenticeship-based training halls, particularly, you know, focused principally on the construction and building trades part of the economy, but a chance to build more new, you know, world-class training facilities, particularly in underserved communities, as a way to welcome more folks into the building and construction trades industry. That event was with the laborers, but it's, you know, applicable to lots of different parts of the building trades ecosystem. So we're really excited about the opportunity to build. You know, there's some great training centers that exist already all throughout the state, but we need more, particularly because as the infrastructure bills come online and things like Gateway happen, you know, the need for more skilled workers in the building and construction trades continues to grow. That's a good thing. And we're really excited to be partnering with labor on that. But again, it's part of a broader partnership that we'll bring to this board probably at the February board meeting that really attempts to cement and memorialize the reality. And Rob and I always sort of quote each other saying this, that, you know, workforce development and economic development are really two sides of the same coin. Sometimes higher ed is in there, and we imagine some sort of three-sided coin, which is like a really Yogi Berra type thing. If, I have a three-sided coin, but good. But there's, you know, tremendous opportunities to really strengthen how we think about our sector strategies around workforce development, around our things like, you know, clean energy economy, and having trained folks to participate in that work as well. So huge opportunities all across the board on that. You have in your pack, too, or at your desk here, the board dashboard for November. Again, you can continue to see just tremendous activity on any number of range of programs. We continue to do incredible work on. These numbers will go up quite a bit after today's meeting as we round the corner into the end of the year. We have a large number of projects or large volume of dollars for consideration today. But, again, you can see the tremendous amount of work that happens on all these programs, you know, all throughout the year. And as we get very close to $1 billion, again, we'll quit way over that. This meeting goes as expected. Well over $1 billion of support to the economy through this year. Just speaks to, I think, the governor's commitment to and the legislature's commitment to providing the resources we need to grow the economy in a way that's focused on strength and fairness, and all these programs to every single one of them on the list here, I think speaks to that strategy and those strategies in one way, shape, or form. We're going to do two quick program updates as part of our sort of steady diet of regular kind of program updates to the board. As part of that, before I hand it to Ivan and Jenna, we'll do two quick program updates. Happy to pause any questions, comments, reactions to my yammering and or the board dashboard.
Yeah, I'd just like, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say I'm taking a look at the board dashboard handout, and I want to just, again, kind of congratulate you and the whole DDA staff, I think the whole state of New Jersey appreciates the efforts of this whole organization. I mean, the numbers are just staggering. If you see them, they're just staggering. You can pick any single category and say, you know, how is this accomplished? Accomplished exponentially, increasing, efficient, and just overall good for the whole economy. I mean, in November, 139 approvals, you know, you do the math, it's like three a day. And I know it just doesn't happen in a day. You know, it's a long effort to make sure that the applications are vetted, but just breaking it down on a daily basis. And you can pick, again, any particular number on this dashboard, and the numbers are staggering. So, again, congratulations to you and the staff on another successful year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so we get two quick program updates. Ivan Mendez is going to do manufacturing voucher program, and then Jen is going to do the first cannabis program or the second cannabis program?
The first one, but there's one light on it.
That's great. Both cannabis programs. Ivan, the floor is yours. Manufacturing voucher program, just by a bit of a drum roll. You know, we've talked about this before, but, you know, manufacturing under President Biden's leadership nationally, under Governor Murphy's leadership here at home, manufacturing is experiencing a renaissance for the first time. We've had sustained job creation and growth in manufacturing, almost 5,000 new jobs in New Jersey in manufacturing. That's the first sustained period of job creation in manufacturing since modern record-keeping started. Got in the 60s to fund sustained manufacturing growth in New Jersey. And this program that I'm going to talk about is really part and parcel of our commitment to not just trying to attract new companies to come here and grow here, although that's important, and we spend a lot of time doing that, but to support the home team and businesses that are, you know, doing their best to sort of stay and fight and deal with the challenges that confront all businesses, but have some wind at their back with regard to modernizing and buying new equipment and all those kinds of things. So, Adam.
Good morning, Chairman Tim and members of the board. Starting with an overview of the program. The program itself, MVPO is created with the goal to provide manufacturers the grants to be able to purchase equipment, allowing them to upgrade to a new modern age of technology of automation, reaching Industry 4.0 standards.
And when was it started?
It was the pre-qualification was December of 2022, and applications were formally taken in March of 2023.
But it didn't exist before that.
Did not.
Governor put money in the governor and legislature put money in the budget in the 22 fiscal 23. Calendar 22 budget. The first time. That was the first meaningful allocation of manufacturing money. Probably also since there's been modern recreation.
Phase one was given a total allocation of $33.75 million from the 2023 state budget and provides awards from 30 to 50% of the cost of eligible equipment, capped at $250,000 per company. MVP targets the state's priority sectors and provides stackable bonuses for WMV businesses. This is an opportunity zone, and an additional bonus for companies who purchase their equipment from New Jersey manufacturers. We thought it important to add that New Jersey manufacturers component to the program to bring the program full circle. Not only are we awarding companies to buy and upgrade equipment, but if they buy their equipment from a New Jersey company, it's a double win.
He doesn't need to hire anybody. He just needs to have this guy do his job.
Can I remind everyone to keep their phone on mute if they're on the button?
So here's some highlights of phase one. We got a total of 269 applications totaling $34.5 million in committed funds. Approximately $134 million in total planned equipment investment by applicants. So from the $34.5 million that we're awarding, it's going to result in about $134 million invested funds from companies. We assisted companies in 20 of the 21 New Jersey counties, Salem County being the one company who did not receive
I'm sorry, it's Jenny Bauer. It's really hard to hear. Somebody has their phone not on mute, and it's hard to hear.
We're trying to do a technology
Give me an exact
Yeah,
quote,
sorry.
So
with phase two, we're hoping to attract some companies from Salem County. We help manufacturers in life sciences, advanced manufacturing, non-retail food and beverage, and other manufacturing. Life science and non-retail food and beverage are probably the two biggest industries that we saw the most applications come from, so we're very happy to help those sectors. Currently, these numbers are probably out of date from the moment I put this together. But at the time when I put this together, it was 22 awards, totaling about $1.5 million in dispersed funds currently. And actively we're reimbursing and dispersing funds every day. And now we're picking it's an uptick. To give more context on that, that's probably about 80% of the submitted reimbursement request. So the program does allow for 12 months with 2 6-month extensions for companies to provide proof of installation delivery, and full payment. So we fully expect these requests to come over the next 12 months, and in some cases even 2 years.
And just as a refresher, we're covering part of the cost, not the whole cost, so you got to go do your part if you're the applicant, and then you got to actually do what you said you're going to do, and we cut you a check as a reimbursement.
You only get the money after the fact.
Right.
It's not just here's the money. Good luck, and keep us posted.
Trying to reconcile the $1.5 million with the $34 million.
Right, so $34 million, as we said, to Terry Coe, here's a $300,000 check, but you only get it if you go find your $700 that you got to go do.
Right. And we built in this long lead time in order to account for the supply chain issues around the globe. Next slide, please. Here we have a breakdown of the amount of companies who applied in these different bonus brackets. So 87 companies were in opportunity zones. 20 companies were state-certified minority-owned business enterprises. 24 were women-owned businesses, and there was one veteran-owned business who applied for the program. Next slide, please. Here's some phase two improvements. So where phase one had a two-step application process with a pre-qualification and a subsequent application, we streamlined it to have only one application. By doing that, we hope to shorten the time from application to disbursement. We're about a year's time. We hope to substantially cut that down to 6 months, even a lot shorter than that. And we did add a bonus to phase two. So with the help of NJMEP, they did help us identify that there are a lot of manufacturers in New Jersey with 50 or less full-time employees. So we thought it important to add this extra bonus in phase two. So it's an additional stackable 5% bonus for manufacturers with less than 50 full-time employees. Next slide. And here's a statement from Pete Connolly from MEP. I'm going to get closer because I can't read. I can't see that. The New Jersey Manufacturing Voucher Program is a catalyst for innovation and growth in our state manufacturing sector. This program empowers companies to invest in cutting-edge technologies, fosters collaboration, and plays a direct role in accelerating our competitiveness as an industry and nation. By leveraging the NJMVP, businesses gain a competitive edge, ensuring a resilient and dynamic future for New Jersey's manufacturing landscape. He continues, small and medium-sized manufacturing businesses will be able to embrace Industry 4.0 and bring their organizations to an entirely new level. Thank you. Any questions?
How well-known is this? I mean, how do we market this to people?
Very popular. So of the $33.75 million received for phase one, it was two different times that we got that money. The first part was $20 million, and then from the same 2023 state budget, we received an additional $13.75 million. Within 3 days, we're oversubscribed for that $20 million. So the $13.75 million came in useful. And for phase two, we currently have $20 million. And although this is not official, we think we may have some left over from phase one.
That's good. So manufacturing is a big sector, but it's pretty organized. So MEP is a pretty good question. So of all the sectors in the world, this is one of the relatively easier places to get the word out and feel like you hit everybody, or most of everybody, because it's sort of
it's a pretty well organized, you know, the, because if you're, I mean, if you're a manufacturing business, you'd be crazy not to.
Right.
Assuming you had a good use of the money, it'd be crazy not to do this. Right?
And enough resources to do that part.
So we have
this time last year, 12 staff waves were making the rounds. Getting the word out, that's why we have really good applications here. And pretty limited, sometimes you're, you know, we get grief of like, well, I didn't know about this program, I would have applied in a little of that, but not tons. We had to right. call us in your early meetings. Generally, there are programs out there where you can, Christina's programs in particular, haven't, there's hundreds of thousands of small businesses, and they're not organized, they're definitionally all over the place. Those are, that's sort of the opposite end of the spectrum. Manufacturing world is easy for you too.
You know, as a manufacturer, there was a number of strategic sectors that also took advantage of. So like biomanufacturing in the state is a very large segment of the economy, and those folks could also take advantage of this. So our sector team also coordinated well with their outreach along with the industry trade group.
Great. Any other questions? Anyone on the phone?
Good.
Thank you.
Yes.
Tour of the cannabis program.
I'm going to load up. So I'll just start while my slides start loading. So good morning. Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for letting me speak on the Cannabis Equity Grant Program. It was a year ago that we were here getting the memo through to the board and the board approval. So I'd just like to thank everyone on the community development team in this room. So many people worked to make this this program a success and really, you know, help a lot of people. Do you want me to just start? Okay. All right, so the Cannabis Equity Grant Program is a $20 million pilot program that is open to conditional and annual recreational cannabis license holders. It utilizes state appropriation to support new businesses in the cannabis industry for their startup and operational costs during the first 3 years of operation. So I just wanted to start by going over a little bit of why it is that we started this program. Equity is at the center of everything that we do at EDA, and it also helps to build a stronger and fairer New Jersey. It invests in New Jersey communities to grow community wealth and incubate a new growth market, provides entrepreneurship opportunities, and promotes equity for individuals who have been most affected by the war on drugs, and to provide funding to businesses in an industry where there is a lack of capital, administrative barriers, and real estate and municipal approval barriers. Next slide, please. So we include this slide in our presentation just because it's very, very important just to see how expensive it is to start a cannabis business in New Jersey, and just to remind everyone that there is a lack of access to capital because cannabis is still illegal on the federal level. So, you know, the ability to access traditional lending products is not there. And those most harmed by the war on drugs actually need the most capital, the most access to capital to start their business. So if you're a manufacturer in New Jersey, it costs anywhere from $3 to $10 million. Cultivators, $3 to $10 million. Retailers on the low end, $650 to $1 million. On the high end, north of $10 million. Next slide, please.
On the high end, right?
Yeah, on the high end. Thank you. That was unintentional. The barriers to entry are very high. There's a lot of administration and applications, very difficult application to convert to your annual. You have to hire lots of consultants to help you with the application. Real estate, there's a very limited amount of real estate. Again, lack of access to capital. Also, when you're leasing or buying, when they find out it's for cannabis, you know, the cost increases exponentially. Lastly, municipal barriers. So, you know, municipalities get to decide whether or not cannabis is going to be in their municipality and where it's going to be. So local zoning controls, local land use, local licensing requirements. There's not one uniform process. Each municipality has their own process.
The municipality can decide not to allow it?
Yes. So currently about 104 municipalities have opted in. Next slide, please. So again, $20 million from the supplemental budget appropriation focusing on providing working capital to new businesses. I just want to note, at first, this program was a $10 million program, but thanks to our CEO, our Chief Community Development Officer, and the government's office, the Gov's office, we were able to secure more funding and double the awards from 24 to 48 for each program. So I'm just going to go over our first program. It launched on 4/20/2023. It's a joint ventures program. So this program is, we targeted an audience targeted to businesses that are farther along in the approval process and have secured site control and municipal approval. And these businesses actually have a really great chance of being able to open and secure their annual license. So it's a non-discretionary grant. $12 million was allocated to the Joint Ventures Grant Program. There's a 40% set-aside for social equity applicants for the first 24 grant awards. I just wanted to note social equity in this context is a term, a designation that the CRC actually permits for businesses who have 51% ownership who have either lived in an economically disadvantaged area or for individuals who have previous cannabis convictions. So if you meet either one of those criteria, you're going to be designated by the CRC as a social equity business. So we had a 40% set aside for this grant. We had a 5% set aside for impact zones, which are cities who have also been negatively affected by the war on drugs. $250,000 grant, we just have to give a shout out to this. This is actually the largest in the country. It's given out in two disbursements. The first one is $100,000 once the grantee shows site control and municipal approval. Second disbursement is after their annual license. So then they open, get through the first year of their business, all of that. The eligible uses for the program may include but are not limited to startup costs associated with the cannabis industry business. Very, very flexible because, again, this is a new industry and it's difficult to determine, your exact cost. Next slide, please. So our second program that launched is the Seed Equity Program. And this is targeted towards businesses who have their conditional license, which is the license you get before your annual license, and need more assistance in the process. We launched this actually a couple weeks ago, November 30th, 2023. $8 million allocated to the program. This is open to social equity applicants only. And there, again, is a 5% set aside for impact zones. This grant is $150,000. There's four milestones. It's given out in four disbursements, four milestones that the grantees need to meet. And there's also a required technical assistance. It's a nine-week technical assistance program that grantees must take in order to be able to access their funds. We did secure a third-party technical assistance provider, Oaks Fam University, which will provide technical assistance to the first 24 grantees. It's culturally competent technical assistance, focusing on topics relevant to starting a cannabis business. Next slide, please. Now I'm just going to go through some of the numbers for our joint ventures applicant pool. Again, launched on 4/20/2023, $12 million allocated. The joint ventures breakdown, 163 applications submitted, 91 applications from minority-owned business enterprises, 72 applications from women-owned business enterprises, 43 applications were from both minority and women-owned business enterprises, and we received submissions from all 21 counties. And I just want to note that actually this program was oversubscribed in about 30 minutes when we opened. So next slide, please. In terms of the approvals, we had 48 applications approved. 24 of the approvals were minority-owned business enterprises, 20 were women-owned, 12 were both minority and women-owned business enterprises. And the joint ventures county breakdown, 14 of the 21 counties were had approvals. Next slide, please. And then this is just kind of the county breakdown of how the awards were spread out. You can see that Hudson and Essex County that were the top two who had the most awards. Next slide, please. And just finally, I'm going to go over the Seed Equity Program, which launched on November 30th. We are in the process of reviewing the applications. We hope to get approvals out early in quarter one. 111 applications submitted, 66 applications, minority-owned business enterprises, 30 applications, women-owned business enterprises, 23 applications, both minority and women-owned business enterprises. And again, we did receive submissions from all 21 counties.
On the joint program, why are people generally declining?
We actually didn't have very many declinations. A couple applicants actually lost their municipal approval. And then the other reason was that the applicants could not prove site control. So that those were the two big reasons.
Any questions? Anyone on the phone? Great.
Thank you so much.
That concludes my CEO report.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to quickly, as we now do, the chairs give quick summaries of the committee meetings that happened between board meetings. I'm going to give the policy committee report, of which I am the chair. The policy committee met on November 30th with a robust agenda. I think all of the items that we discussed at that meeting will be presented today for the board's consideration. We had two memos on requests for updates to delegations of authority. We had a recommendation for a contract award for an independent compliance auditor. Three MOU agreements with other state agencies were presented for approval. One pertained to an MOU with BPU, the Bureau of Public Utilities, to accept funding to support federal broadband application. One pertaining to accepting funding to be used by for the construction of the Maternal Infant and Infant Health Innovation Center. And lastly, one pertaining to a grant agreement with Tech United to support the women and minority-owned businesses membership cohort. Three memos under the community development program were presented, including a new program, the Atlantic City Revitalization Grant Program, a memo in support of the Arts and Innovation Program for the North Shore Festival in partnership with NJPAC, and a memo providing awards and declinations for Activation, Revitalization, and Transformation, or ART, Public Space Activation Grants. And lastly, two real estate-related contracting memos were presented. And with that, we'll get into the specifics. First up on community development, Christina is going to present on the Atlantic City Revitalization Grant Program.
Thank you. This action item is requesting board approval to create a new pilot grant program that will help address the negative impacts of the pandemic in Atlantic City by supporting capital projects that address and improve the community's neighborhoods within Atlantic City. So this grant will look to activate underutilized or vacant land for projects to promote equitable economic growth and support local communities and neighborhoods throughout Atlantic City. We will utilize $19,650,000 from a $30 million state budget line item from our Fiscal Year Appropriations Act, identified as Atlantic City Initiative. NJEDA will utilize a 5% administrative fee of $982,500 in addition to the $19,650,000 to support grant awards. Since this funding is federal, staff is seeking delegated authority for the CEO to enter into an MOU with the New Jersey Department of Community Affairs as well to accept and utilize the funding. The program will provide grants to for-profit, nonprofit entities responsible for overseeing a real estate development project and will cover 50% of soft and hard construction costs for community-driven capital projects with a minimum award of $1 million and a maximum award of $10 million. Applicants that seek to revitalize Atlantic City from the impact of COVID-19 must fall into at least one of the following local impact classifications to ensure the community will benefit from the applicant's project. Those classifications will be small business support efforts, clean and safe efforts, food insecurity efforts, downtown vitality efforts, and job and office space creation. Plus, they also have to meet eligibility criteria as identified in your board memo and product specs as well. Since this is federally funded, the program will also incorporate various certifications at time of application to ensure applicants and their projects can meet the necessary federal eligibility criteria that NJEDA will be enforcing. Applications will be accepted on a rolling basis and will be open until all funds are awarded. There will also be an application fee of $1,000 accompanied with each application and at time of application. So, and all approvals and declines will proceed to board for approval as well. I'm happy to take any questions.
The governor included some federal funds, meaningful federal funding in the budget last year. We used some of that to start the and kickstart the food security work that Tara had presented to the board in October. Balance of it with a little bit held in reserve for some more ART funding. February meeting, so it's, you know, Atlantic City needs lots of continued support. It's had, you know, it was having a rough go of it before the pandemic, and the pandemic particularly tough on New Atlantic City. So this is a huge opportunity to begin to get back on our front foot there.
Yeah, we have a lot of Atlantic City related things today.
Yes, we do.
We did in at the last, I guess, October board meeting as well.
Big commitment focus.
Anyone on the phone, any board members, questions, comments?
No.
I'm fine, thank you.
Good, Robert.
For the grants for the soft cost and construction, prevailing wage applied to the...
Absolutely. Duplication of benefits as well, right? So they can't receive any additional federal or state grants. That would be for the same cost as well. And there's also a time frame from the federal treasury, right? We have to meet the end of 2026 for the money to be spent. So that's why we have to, like, kind of move this. I'm going to launch probably early, late January for the application so they can get started and moving ahead. But
money actually has to be spent by the end of the 2026?
Yeah, as of now, that's what the time frame is. There's talks of extension of that, but I can't guarantee you that. So we have to get things going.
Because it's federal?
Yes. Yep.
Tied up in the Ukraine border, Israel, funny
really?
No, I'm joking. I think that needs is more things on the list.
Any other comments, questions, discussion? Hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
So moved.
Jenny Gower, I'll move it.
Thank you. Jenny, you want a second?
Sure. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, let's call for a vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the program is approved.
I have the next
one. Yes, you do. Go ahead. Arts and Innovation Funding.
So this item is requesting board approval to allocate a fiscal year 2024 Appropriations Act item, which appropriated EDA $5 million of funding towards supporting New Jersey arts and innovation. Of that $5 million, NJPAC was designated $3 million per the Appropriations Act for the 2024 North Shore Festival. This grant agreement in the memo will memorialize how that funding will be utilized by NJPAC and how EDA will disperse funds to ensure the funding directly supports the 2024 festival that will be taking place in the summer. The remaining $2 million allocated will be used by EDA to support sponsorships up to $500,000 to outside entities that will help in leveraging the authority's work, image, and brand, either in conjunction with the North Shore Festival or other arts and innovation programs and events. Staff will utilize delegated authority to enter into the sponsorships and will do so according to the authority sponsorship standard operating policy.
So I think when we talked about this committee, we will have a more prominent placement.
Presence and branding, yeah. So we can be tied into those events that take place as well, too, although we aren't.
And does NJPAC administer North Shore for the whole state?
Yes.
Yeah, it's in three cities, but yes.
And just a reminder that next year is our 50th anniversary of the EDA, so it's a good time to be out there. Any comments, questions? Anyone on the phone? Okay, hearing none, can I hear a motion to approve?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Robert. Is that a second?
Yes.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you. Melissa, award and declination of activation, revitalization, and transformation, or ART.
Good morning. I am here to present the awards and definitions for the public space activation portion of the ART grant program. So on October 11, 2022, the EDA board approved the activation, revitalization, and transformation grant program. We affectionately call it ART. The goal of the program is to partner with our local entities, proactively addressing the negative impacts of the pandemic on our communities by creating an environment necessary to attract and retain talent, enable business creation and attractions in our downtown. The program was capitalized with $10 million of ARP funding, and Atlantic City and Newark were identified for the pilot program. Each city was allocated with $5 million, so a 70% split focused on real estate and a 30% on public space activation projects. And I'm going to present the real estate award at a future board meeting, but I'm going to get into the details about the public space right now. So we began accepting applications on May 30th, 2023. We had a 60-day business window, and that ended on August 22nd. We received
17 public space applications, and 16 of those were moved to committee for scoring, and one was deemed incomplete for failure to pay application fees. The split was 4 applications from Atlantic City and 12 from Newark. The applications were reviewed for completeness by staff and determined to be eligible before presented to their respective scoring committees. The scoring committees met in October and returned the applications in November. And as part of this review process, an application must meet a minimum scoring threshold of 65 out of 100 possible points. The Public Space Activation Scoring Committee was comprised of various subject matter experts among EDA staff, and they determined scores for each of the applications individually. I'll go into the results now. So for Atlantic City, we have 3 projects. The first one that scored the highest was Stockton University, receiving 81.7 out of 100 points. And they are recommended for a reward of $1,001,300 to install neighborhood gateway and wayfinding signs and support citywide arts and culture marketing in Atlantic City. The next was Inlet Public-Private Association, receiving 78 out of 100 possible points. And they are recommended for award of $250,000 to support the historic Epsicon Lighthouse with general operating support, as well as to continue their growth and community engagement. The final one for Atlantic City was Atlantic City Arts Foundation, receiving 77 out of 100 points. And they will be receiving $248,700 to restore and protect murals that have been damaged by weather and time throughout the city. Next up is Newark. The Public Space Scoring Committee determined the application from Newark Alliance would receive 91.3 points out of 100, being our top scoring applicant in the category, and they are recommended to receive a grant award of $1.5 million to support Festivals United, a coordinated marketing and public relations campaign that will leverage ongoing efforts of multiple festivals taking place throughout the city. Additionally, staff recommends the declination of awards to the following applicants based on their comparatively lower scores of the scoring committee and the full use of the available funds for the 4 higher scoring applications. Those are Atlantic City Metro Business and Citizens Association Foundation, Newark Arts Council, Pratt Foundation, Newark Museum, Kearney Point, PBS STEAM, Project for Empty Space, Yendorf Sanctuary for the Arts, Clinton Hill Community Action, Newark Arts Council presents Newark Moonlight Cinema, Create and Get Empowered, and New Jersey Performing Arts. That's the end of my presentation. I'm happy to take any questions.
Do they have any right to appeal the declinations?
Yes. Yes. They would do that right this moment. They would be declined first before they can appeal.
Right. Yeah. They will get a notice, and then they can do that.
And then do you have to wait to resolve that before the grant money is awarded?
I'm assuming, yes, I believe this is a total amount of funding,
million,
so
right? Yeah.
There's a theoretical possibility that the
ranking
could change depending on.
That was a very well-subscribed program when we received
great
applications.
We just went through it and I saw the 4 up there. That's what I was trying to write about.
A lot of declinations.
Was there a scoring threshold for them to make it into the top tier for the award?
So you had to meet 65 points, and then we ranked them highest to lowest based on the amount of funding available.
You spent the money essentially.
Yes,
we spent
our money.
Yeah. There are other worthy applications on the list. It's just there's X amount of money for every
student. Anyone on the phone? Questions? Comments?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks, Tara.
Hearing none, can I hear a motion to approve?
Jenny Bauer, I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Second?
Jewel Antoine, second.
Thank you, Jewel. Any further discussions? We haven't voted yet.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Sorry.
All those in favor signify by saying
aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, it is approved.
Now you're good.
Thank you.
I like taking a 3-point shot.
I've been watching.
Yeah.
next we're going to go to...
they don't do that anymore, George. Everybody wins.
The MOU and agreement presentations. Pamela Taylor on maternal and infant health and economic security.
Hello. Hi, everyone. So I'm really excited to present this today. And just to give everyone kind of just a general overview and to refresh our memory, so EDA is in charge of implementing the Maternal Infant Health Innovation Center, which we're really, really excited about. The center will have three major components. One of those components is the Institute of Higher Ed, which will focus on training and building the perinatal workforce, a clinical provider who will provide that comprehensive perinatal care, and a multi-service organization that will be charged for resource navigation and care coordination. So I just wanted to start with that. We are requesting to enter into an MOU with DCA to receive the $20 million of American Rescue Plan funds that were appropriated to us. So this is more so like a procedural mechanism for us to receive those funds. These were appropriated to us through fiscal year 2023, and these funds will directly support the maternal and infant health construction. We would like to embark on this a process to get these funds now so they can be accessible at the time of construction, and we anticipate the MOU being fully executed, hopefully in early 2024. One thing I want to also mention is that we are also working with Keene University, Watson Institute for Urban Policy and Research, and they're actively conducting our community engagement process. This is important because they speak to women and families about what they would like to see in the center, and so the three major components that I mentioned earlier, the community engagement process was directly correlated, or it worked with advising, so we landed on those three components. We continue to actively engage the community, and we look forward to bringing this center to Trenton. As you can see, we also have secured additional funding for construction for the center, and I'm happy to take any questions.
We'll be back when we go to spend.
Right. So at this stage, as you said, it's a procedural matter to accept the funds, mm-hmm. put them on our balance sheet,
yep.
and then proceed.
We'll, back.
We'll come back to the for actually
how we're going to spend all that.
Any questions? Hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve the, this is, again, the MOU with, who's with, the Department of Community Affairs to accept the $20 million in funding.
So moved.
Thank you. Second?
Joel, second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Could I hear all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals or abstentions? Hearing none, motion is approved. Thank you. Good luck.
You'll see me again.
Clark Smith on the approval of the grant agreement with the New Jersey Technical Council.
Clark, before you jump in, just by a bit of framing, this is an item that was in the state budget. Was very specific. We did so supporting obviously minority women entrepreneurship is great. We do that in lots of different ways. We didn't like run a contest or a competition to say who do we want to award this funding to. The budget resolution said $250,000 Tech United Minority Women Founders Mentorship Program. Now it has to comply with all of our rules. You have to like it that it fits within our program, good behaviors and all that kind of jazz. But like this couldn't go to some other organization or second place runner up here or whatever. Just by a bit of process comment here.
Well, thank you and good morning. Actually, Clark Smith, I'm the Director of Innovation Programs, and I'm also along here with Priya Sheik, who is our Innovation Analyst on our team and will be actually implementing the program. So the proposal for your consideration is for the transfer of funds and associated grant agreement between the New Jersey Technology Council, which is also known in the market as Tech United, and us, the NJEDA. The 2024 Appropriations Act appropriated funds to the NJEDA for Tech United's specific women and minority business owner mentorship program. A little bit about Tech United. It is a nonprofit here in New Jersey. It is the largest technology industry trade and advocacy group in the state, and their membership ranges from cutting-edge startups all the way up to large Fortune 500 companies. And with that, I'll pass it on to Farida, who will discuss the actual program itself.
Thank you, Clark.
So the Women and Minority Business Owners Mentorship Program is an established program for Tech United. The program facilitates opportunities for New Jersey women and minority entrepreneurs to receive business-related education, networking opportunities, and one-on-one business mentorship. These activities can take place both virtually and in person. Tech United manages an application and selection process for both program participants and their potential mentors. Upon selection, the participants are organized in a cohort and matched with mentors. Then, over 3 months, participants engage in a series of group sessions and one-on-one meetings with a mentor. Finally, mentorship summit events allow for further engagement with participants, mentors, and the larger business community. The proposed grant would be for 3 years from the date of its execution, with an option to extend it for an additional year if needed. The allocation is for $250,000. After the NJEDA's 5% administration fee, $237,500 would be available for disbursement on a milestone basis to support program setup costs, cohort administration, and summit events as outlined in the memo. Additionally, Tech United will maintain a program-specific website and promote the program through their various marketing channels. This concludes our prepared comments. Happy to discuss and answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Any board members on the phone, questions, comments? Hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
Robert
Chemdow. Bauer,
I'll move it. Bill Lodge is second.
Thank you, Phil. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, it is approved. Thank you. Emma, on an MOU with the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities.
Good morning. The members of the board are asked to approve the signing of a memorandum of understanding between the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities, BPU, and the New Jersey Economic Development Authority for the transfer of $1.7 million for payment to McKinsey & Company for federal broadband grant application assistance under the authority's current contract for strategic consulting services in support of CHIPS and IRA. As the board is aware, in April of this year, the authority entered into a 12-week contract with McKinsey for an analysis of the CHIPS and Science Act and the Inflation Reduction Act to determine how New Jersey can best leverage the funding provided in both federal packages. During those 12 weeks, McKinsey analyzed all 140-plus programs made available under the CHIPS and IRA and determined that the opportunities there translated into $20 billion in funding for the state, split across $1.5 billion in competitive grants and $17.5 billion in tax incentive uptake. In order to best leverage the opportunity for New Jersey presented under these bills, the Authority Board approved this July an additional 5 months of supportive services from McKinsey valued at $4,768,225, of which the Board of Public Utilities paid $4.5 million and the EDA paid the remaining $268,225. As part of the extended scope of work, in addition to supporting the state's CHIPS and IRA applications, McKinsey was approved to provide 4 weeks of support services to the New Jersey Office of Broadband Connectivity for funding opportunities made available under the Broadband Equity, Access, and Development, the BEAD program, and the Digital Equity Act. After McKinsey provided the initial 4 weeks of service, it was determined by BPU that they would require more than 1 month of application assistance from McKinsey in order to fully secure the funding made available to the state under the BEAD program and the Digital Equity Act. In response, McKinsey provided an additional 8 weeks of service to the BPU, which results in a successful submission of an application for an award of $1,176,741 under the Digital Equity Planning Grant and the creation of various plans for broadband access, affordability, equity, and adoption across the state under the $4,922,089 awarded to New Jersey by NTIA for the BEAD Planning Grant. Due to the $6 million in grant planning funds currently received by the state for broadband and the over $263 million the state is allocated to receive for broadband assistance, proper support for BPU during the application planning grant phase was essential to ensure that New Jersey was poised to secure the federal funding made available for these initiatives statewide. Since the 8 weeks of work has already been provided to the BPU by McKinsey, the board is being asked to approve the signing of the MOU between the EDA and BPU
to receive the $1.7 million for payments to McKinsey for services rendered, as well as approve updating the current scope of work between the EDA and McKinsey to accurately reflect the additional weeks of services rendered for broadband, updating the contract language from that initial 4 weeks to the total of 12. So with that, I'll open it up if folks have any questions.
So Emma, is this, are we paying for work that's already been done?
Yes.
So this is a bill for paying?
Yes.
And then just remind us, I know when we discussed McKinsey's retention at the beginning, so this question of what are we investing and what are we getting for it? And you mentioned that New Jersey's been allocated how much?
This is specifically for broadband, it's a different package. It's going to be Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act, but $263 million has already been allocated to Safer Broadband. They're now going through the process of grant application by grant application, drawing that down. So we're up to 263. If our applications are as good as they say they should be, we'll get it. CHIPS and IRA is structured differently, so it's more there's funding available for every opportunity. There's 140. New Jersey has to compete for every single one of them.
So we've been allocated $263 million for broadband.
Up top from the feds, yeah.
We, the state, BPU.
BPU is going to handle
that. Not our table, as they say, the rest of the industry, I guess.
But because BPU paid such a significant amount of the first piece of the contract, we added broadband in, since that's really, in the grand scheme of things, their most urgent need. They have that $263 million pool in front of them. CHIPS and IRA isn't as guaranteed as an infrastructure investment job.
What do we think, when would the state start getting that money?
They started getting it right now for planning. It will start to trickle in, I think, second quarter of 2024 is when the rest will start to come, but it'll be slow.
Do people recognize that?
The public, which probably not.
$250 million for broadband is pretty good.
Yep. Okay. There was a big press event a year ago, I want to say. We were part of this BPU. I
want to say 2022. And is it rural or is it general infrastructure throughout the state?
It's
infrastructure, you know, last mile type stuff, meaning?
Cities.
Yeah. Urban. Okay. Any comments or questions? Seems to me we should pay our bills. can I hear a motion to approve?
Dragon motion.
Jenny Bauer, I'll move it.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to consider Jenny that's a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you. Jenny, do you want to give the incentives report?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The incentives committee met on November 29th. Our staff presented two Aspire applications. One is in Sayreville. The other is in Hoboken. They also presented two film and digital media tax credits. These are the first for approval since the actor's strike, which has been resolved, fortunately. And then there was we were followed by a hearing officer's recommendation on two NOLs that are being appealed. And that was it. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Jenny. Okay, we'll move on with the agenda, considering the items Jenny mentioned. The first up is Aspire Kevin Smith on the Sayreville Seaport Associates Urban Renewal application.
Thank you. So we are seeking your approval to award up to $400 million in Aspire tax credits to a mixed-use residential project. As noted by the chairman in his opening remarks, the project is located south of the Driscoll Bridge near the Chevalier Avenue exit off the Garden State Parkway in Sayreville and is known as Riverton. The applicant is proposing the redevelopment of a significant portion of a former inorganic manufacturing facility that has been undergoing remediation under the supervision of DEP since 2010. Again, as noted earlier, the project will comprise a town center entailing just over 2 million in total square feet of new construction, including nearly 1.3 million square feet of residential uses and just under 800,000 square feet of commercial uses. The residential uses will entail a total of 1,135 units, consisting of studios, one, two, and three bedrooms, with 20% of those units reserved as affordable. The project will be completed over 10 years in five phases and is being considered as a phased transformers project on account of satisfying various criteria included in the program rules. So at this point, we have five slides here that we can just look at real quickly, and it just shows kind of the, so this image is of the entire site, and then what is in red here is the, it's phase one. So the larger block 1A is going to be a Bass Pro Shop, like anchor store, very impressive. And then the bottom 1B is kind of adjacent, like light retail. I think one of them is a gas station. It's other like small, just kind of support amenities for this larger retail use. And then you'll see it kind of starts, we'll be moving across the site from right to left. And so the next phase, if we want to go to the next slide, is now in blue. And you can see this block at the top is going to be all retail. The next block is restaurant. And then 2B is and 2B and 2A are kind of a very mixed use combination of parking, apartments, restaurants, and retail. If we go to the third phase, you'll see this is now like what they describe as the urban core of this town center. So it's going to be it's much denser, and you'll see there's office there, retail, restaurant, parking, and then where's the residential?
Apartments.
Right, and so this is going to be like very, on account of seeing how hard it was, this is very dense residential, right? It's much more contained than the former sites. And then if we go to four, you'll see, again, pretty dense. It's a variety of uses. And then the last five is yellow and five. And so it basically just moves from the entry of the site, and they work back towards the river. And then this kind of blue site up this blue, light blue space above the site, that is additionally part of this longstanding brownfield that will be redeveloped, and there's some ongoing remediation there still, but that is all beyond the scope of this award, and is likely to happen, you know, years from now.
I was going to say, so over the five phases, how long does that take?
It's 10 years is the total kind of like from start to finish.
So we're thinking about this as a 10-year project for us.
Right. It's really even longer than that, but the construction is 10 years, right?
Yeah.
So the board memo provides more details, including the unit size and mix of the residential components of the project, the timing of each phase, the mix of the commercial and residential uses in each phase, and further explanation of the remediation activities undertaken at the larger site. The memo also provides greater explanation as to the ability of the project to be completed in phases, and the specific criteria satisfied to be considered a transformative project. So the applicant is wholly owned by PRISA 2 LHC LLC, which is a Delaware limited liability company that qualifies as a real estate investment trust or a REIT. PRISA 2 LHC LLC is also the lead development entity, as it is directing North American Properties Atlanta Limited, who has served as a contract advisor since 2017, performing a variety of development functions to create a new vision for the site based off of its extensive experience in placemaking and large-scale mixed-use projects. So I think this was noted before. The total development budget is just over $1 billion at $1,088,708,765, inclusive of all phases. To help size the award, we exclude costs that are prohibited by statute and program rules. The total eligible project costs are $918,843,509, including all phases. The memo provides further detail on the investment entailed by each phase. The developer must contribute at least 20% equity, or in this case, roughly $217.7 million. Equity consists of land valued at roughly $102.5 million, which represents the implied value of a ground lease held by the applicant, and roughly $275.2 million in cash. So this well exceeds this 20% minimum. The sources table in the memo shows there are a variety of funding sources expected in the deal and breaks them down by phase. The applicant will have to fully evidence these capital stacks no later than 90 days prior to the expected construction date reflected in the memo, with the exception of the first phase, where, as is typical of an Aspire award, they will have 1 year from this approval to fully evidence those sources. Additional conditions of this approval are detailed in the memo. We subject the applicant's request to the program's various award caps. In this case, the project is eligible to receive up to 50% of total eligible costs, or $400 million, whichever is less on account of being a transformative project. As explained in the memo, as a phased transformative project, the applicant would actually unlock a series of tax credits associated with each phase that would be capped at 50% of the project cost for that phase, again, with the total award always capped at $400 million. The memo provides greater detail on the expected value of the Aspire tax credits associated with each phase. To help further size the award, we look at the project's rate of return. In this case, we use a project-specific hurdle rate, which is provided by EDA's contracted consultant, Jones Lang LaSalle. With the benefit of the Aspire tax credits, the equity IRR is 9%, which is below the hurdle rate for comparable developments of 16.5%. So based on the aforementioned factors, we are recommending an Aspire award of up to $400 million, again, not to exceed 50% of project costs in any phase, for board approval. And at this point, I'm happy to take your questions.
You know, Kevin, we had extensive discussion about this in committee, but just, again, for the broader board, PRISA is Prudential?
Right. So PRISA is effectively the real estate investment activities of Prudential.
But it's a REIT. Is it an independent REIT?
Yes. Yes, and there's an actual I can't recite it by heart, but there's a description in the developer entity. It's a closed source font. I forget what it says, but it kind of just describes those technical aspects of it, and it gives some more specific. I think on the type of investment.
And then our Aspire awards, the tax credits are allocated by phase, right?
Right. So nothing gets, they don't earn any tax credits until they complete construction, right? So the $400 million.
For phase.
Yeah. So the $400 million is well protected, but even in the event of, like, each phase, they only unlock what they do.
So after phase two, it's, you know, whatever reason they stop.
Right. So there are actually meaningful consequences if they only complete phase one, right? Because at that point, it's just a commercial project, right? So it's certainly
not a transformer
at that point. And also, if we were considering it as a purely commercial project, it would be subject to the net benefit test and a variety of other considerations, right?
And we'll have the ability to go back in.
Right. So if they stop at phase one, there's really big consequences. At some point through the course of phases two through five, they're going to develop enough residential units where they will then have qualified as a transformative project without regard for finishing this, like, massive project. If that were to happen, we're going to subject the kind of pro forma that we've looked at to make this approval and this 16.5% reasonable return on investment. And based on, you know, a smaller project where they're realizing some of the cash flow sooner than those 10-year and 20 years, really, in reality, for how long the analysis is, we're going to say, okay, well, based on the actual project, what is your IRR, and is it, you know, what are the implications of shedding these two or three phases? So there is going to be a lot of scrutiny and a lot of opportunities for us to say, okay, did they do everything they need? And again, all of the annual tax credits are still subjected to them satisfying on an annual basis for every single phase that they've done all of the things they have to do with respect to affordable housing and prevailing wage and, you know, any of the other.
Phase three is like the big one. That's 337 million.
Right. That's that real, like, dense urban core.
This is Jenny. I just want to say I think this is a fabulous project, and it sounds like we have all the right guardrails in. So I think it's wonderful. I'm happy to move it if you'd like.
Do you know why the redeveloper only has a land lease and not title to it?
I don't. I think they have it from the it's from the Sayreville Redevelopment Authority. I imagine it is largely related to the nature of the it was condemned by way of, it was taken by way of condemnation because of the
remediational needs, and I think, yeah, I think
national lead, right?
Yeah, it's, I think the ownership is very, it's, there's still ongoing remediation, so I think it's very much, it's not a, a clean sale is just not, is not feasible.
I'm assuming this fits within the Aspire program, that a land lease qualifies, long-term
yeah,
land lease?
Yeah.
Assume it's 99 years or
something like that. Yeah, and we, it's a 99-year, and we actually see a lot of times, we've probably presented projects over the course of the last year that have been basically 99-year ground leases from some public land. It's just a, it's a common instrument in these redevelopment scenarios.
And the EDA obligation is 20 years except for the affordability controls that go for 45. So even those are less than the ground lease.
Right, which is some, which, so the plus 35 or plus 45 is a new kind of flight control test that we're applying to projects.
Okay. I mean, the thing that kind of strikes me about this one is, you know, the IRR, even with the Aspire tax credit, is
9%. Right. It's big risk.
And yeah, and I mean, so I mean, there's, you know, we did, it's important to me, I think, that we do this in phases, right? Because, you know, hope they. I mean, I agree with Ginny. It's a huge, I don't want to say eyesore, huge open spot as you drive down on the parkway. To have that developed, it would be fantastic. But you know, it's a big project that lasts a long time.
Yeah.
I do have a question.
Yes, sir.
Between the labor Harvard agreement and the prevailing wage obligations, they have a project labor agreement on this project. How did that get put into the project?
I think that was part of the redevelopment agreement that was negotiated.
Long before
Aspire. It's in there purely for informational purposes and kind of add context to the labor components of the project that are admirable, but it is not separate. It would not supersede any of the requirements of Aspire.
Right, because I would like to tell you the truth, I'd like to see the board look into having other projects have the project labor agreements. You look at even the Trenton project that we just approved, you're going to see a lot of competition from Pennsylvania. The Hoboken job with the residential portion of it, you're going to see a lot of competition with New York workers, so how does the board move forward to see if we can get project labor agreements on projects so that we make sure that New Jersey residents at least can work on the projects that we are funding?
Yeah, there's two pieces of that. When there's projects that we control proprietarily, so the Windport, that's all being done under PLA, the Maternal Health Center is what you're referring to, that'll be us holding those contracts. It's not done yet, but we'll do that under a PLA for 99.9% damn sure. When it's a client, for like whether we're a client or a third-party project, so the Hoboken project, this one, we don't have the statutory authority to require it. We certainly encourage it. Prevailing wage, you often is a very helpful framework to bring everybody to the table and get to one, because it's often to the advantage of the developer, as you know. PLA is a harmonious way to work as opposed to having to kind of fight every fight day to day. And so certainly we encourage that. Statutorily, we don't have the requirement ability to require a PLA. I don't know if there's constitutional issues on that. If the legislature chose to impose one, I don't think the administration would. There has never been that requirement.
Can it be done, though?
Legislatively?
Right. Legislature has to pass it. It's the governor's desk and all that. Yeah, Fred. Hi, Fred.
Tim, I'm the worst lawyer in the room right now, but the only constitutional challenges to the PLA have been the $5 million threshold. So I don't say it here, but again, I'm the worst lawyer in the room. So.
we got some good ones in the room, so it's a tough competition. But, yeah, no, again, so there is no statutory framework for it now. If there was to be one, implemented badly. And so, again, we're projects where we're in charge. So the Toronto Health Center will be one for sure. I believe we did a PLA for the health and ag buildings. Taxation buildings, excuse me, before my time. So the Windport's under a PLA. Netflix is doing a PLA. They're not required. They're just doing one because smart, good things.
You know what? That's good. It's great stuff on your part, Tim. I mean that, too.
Thanks, Ben.
Anyone else? Board members on the phone, any questions for Kevin? Any further discussion?
Okay. Could I hear a motion to approve proceeding with the Aspire grants to the Sevierville Seaport Associates project?
Dragon, motion.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Second?
I'll second Jenny Bauer.
Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, it passes. Kevin, good luck. This is our largest award yet, right?
It's the largest you can do. It's the cap of it. It's the top of the Aspire, the transformative cap.
Okay, great.
And not just because she moved the motion, but shout out to Elizabeth and the team at DEP. The brownfield dimension of this site has been as complex as it gets. Across many multiple administrations, I know Sean and Elizabeth and the entire team at DEP has been in this one aggressively, thoughtfully, but aggressively over the years.
Great. Next up, Annie, on the Observer Highway Urban Renewal LLC project.
Good morning, everyone. We are seeking approval to award $90 million in Aspire tax credits to a mixed-use project in Hoboken. The project is located at Observer Highway and is known as Hoboken Connect Residential. The applicant is proposing the ground-up construction of a 27-story high-rise complex with 386 units, including studios, 1, 2, and 3 bedroom apartment units. It's currently the site of a New Jersey Transit parking lot next to Hoboken Terminal. The residential unit mix includes 308 market rate units and 78 affordable. The affordable piece will also include studios, 1, 2, and 3 bedroom units with affordability levels targeting household area median incomes as low as 35%. And the project will also include roughly 1,200 square feet of commercial space. And the board memo also gives more, you know, details on unit sizes, price ranges, et cetera. Ownership is between Elcor Project JV LLC, which is wholly owned by the lead development entity, Elcor Operating Company LLC, one, and two, the California State Teachers Retirement System, also known as CalSTRS, which is the largest educator-only pension fund in the world and the second largest pension fund in the country. So Elcor and CalSTRS represent the ownership of the applicant via several pass-through entities. The total development budget is $259,198,565. And to help size the award, we excluded costs that are prohibited by statute and program rules, bringing down the total eligible project cost to $234,856,530. The funding structure is simple in that it's just one source of debt, which is the construction loan, and the rest of the project will be funded with equity. The developer has to contribute at least 20% equity, or in this case, roughly $51 million. Here, the developer is contributing to $116.5 million at 45% equity, which is well above the minimum requirement. We subject the applicant's request to the program's various award caps. The project is eligible to receive up to 60% of total eligible costs, or $90 million, whichever is less, in this case, the $90 million. And to help further size the award, we looked at the project's rate of return. We used the hurdle rate model provided by JLL. And with the benefit of the Aspire tax credit, the equity IRR is 10.68%, which is below the hurdle rate for comparable multifamily development in Hoboken at 14.96. As you can see on the slide here, this project is part of a larger development, and so we think that it'll be catalytic and transformative for the area. And so for those reasons, we're recommending an Aspire award of $90 million for board approval.
Would the next development be the parking lot west of the Star?
Okay. Yeah, so it's site two. It's very small, but which is intended for office space. But given the influx of office space and the real estate market for that right now, the priority is the residential development.
Have we done business with Elcor before?
No? Not yet. This is the first time.
They're a national developer. This Hoboken, it's worth noting. Both the project you just approved,
thank you,
and this project These were on my radar on, like, my first day on the job. I mean, this is Elkhorn project circling in Hoboken, and this is Riverton project circling in there. But these are important. Let's hope to try and get these done at some point. For any of a variety of reasons, here we are 6 years later, and happen to do both in the same day, hopefully. This is also tied up the lower right-hand corner. There's this Hoboken terminal. That's the transit center in Hoboken, which is part of the redevelopment here, the engine transit team and DOT.
They've been instrumental
in sort of advancing this, because this is also very complex from an engineering, land use, circulation perspective.
And to add to what Tim is saying, this partnership was between New Jersey Transit and Elkhorn was formed in 2005. So it's been a long time coming, and it's exciting that we get to help launch the beginning part of the development.
Yeah, I would think this would be a very popular location, residential right next to the path to New York.
Certainly.
There's also, like, a terminal building that's in pretty bad state that's going to be redeveloped and has, like, beautiful views of the river. And it's likely suited for, I think, like, big event space, which is also part of kind of the larger project. There's some improvements to the space that are more like public infrastructure that are neither the commercial or the residential project, but are just generally bringing this entire large space back to life.
Those were largely, if not entirely, funded in the 23 budget by some Edwards funding. Administration.
Questions? Other comments?
So is New Jersey Transit joint venturing with Elkhorn? Is Elkhorn acquiring the property?
It's a ground lease.
It's a ground lease. Okay.
Anyone on the phone? Comments? Questions?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
Jenny Bauer, I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Second?
Dragon, second.
Elizabeth. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes. Good luck. Next up, we have two film and digital media tax credits presentations.
Thank you, Chairman. As mentioned, this is our first presentation since both strikes wrapped up in November. DA staff has completed the review and recommends the approval of two applications under the Film and Digital Media Tax Credit Program. We've received written confirmation from an outside firm hired to review the production budgets and to make sure it's reasonable for industry standards. All the film content has been reviewed and recommended for approval under the Act by the New Jersey Motion Picture and Television Commission. Total credits utilized across the recommended film approvals is over $35.7 million. The first project, first application under consideration is Stalwart Productions, LLC, who is responsible for the production of The Walking Dead Summit. This project includes a 2% diversity bonus, and in total we are recommending an award of $24.5 million. The second application is for Apple Studios, LLC, who is responsible for the production of Wild Vale. This project also has a 2% diversity bonus, and for this project we are recommending an award of just over $11.1 million. Each of these projects will need its own vote. Happy to take any questions.
Any questions, comments? All right, so can I hear a motion first on to approve the Stalwart Productions tax credit? Motion?
Robert, second.
Thank you, Robert, second.
Second.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion is approved. Secondly, the tax credits to Apple Studios for the Wild Vale production. Could I hear a motion to approve?
Dragon.
Antoine Johnson, motion to approve.
Thank you. Elizabeth, can I consider that a second?
Sounds good.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none.
Thank you.
Approved. Good luck. Next, we will move to two appeals
on declinations of NOL grants. The next two items on the agenda relate to the hearing officer's recommendation regarding an application declination and the applicant's appeal of the same. Prior to the board's vote, pursuant to the authority's public comment policy, a single person speaking on behalf of the applicant appealing the decision will be permitted to speak for a maximum of 3 minutes to the board before the board votes on the appeal. The next two items the hearing officer will present, the board will then acknowledge one person, the applicant. If he or she wishes to speak before the board, they may speak, and that will happen before the board then takes a vote. The board serves as the final decision maker. If the applicant is dissatisfied with the board's final administrative decision, it may appeal to the appellate division of the Superior Court of New Jersey, pursuant to the rules of the court. So Marcus is going to present on the first NOL appeal.
Morning, everyone. This matter is an appeal of the declination of Thinkster Learning's application for the 2023 Technology Business Tax Certificate Transfer Program, commonly referred to as the NOL program. Following thorough review of the record, I am recommending that the declination be upheld as their previous loan default prohibits them from receiving a state economic subsidy. This declination is based on several grounds related to Thinkster's default on a previous Edison Innovation loan, which are NJSA 52:18-52, which explicitly prohibits applicants who have defaulted on state-awarded loans from receiving a state economic subsidy. Also, a cross-default provision in their Edison loan agreement, insufficient documentation to meet the eligibility requirements of the program, and an incorrect certification by Thinkster's CEO regarding the loan default. Thinkster contested these grounds, claiming they were unaware of the default as they had not received any formal notice of such, and maintained that the CEO certification about the loan default status was made in good faith. The company failed to make full payments on its loan, including a $260,000 payment due in 2022, and then approximately $600,000 balloon payment that was due in July of 2023. Thinkster Learning argued that they were not aware of the default status, insisting that no formal notification of default was ever received from the EDA. Thinkster argues, therefore, that the CEO certification of no default was executed in good faith. However, under the terms of the loan agreement, failure to pay is an event of default, regardless of whether the lender formally notifies the borrower of such. Thinkster Learning incorporates the arguments are insufficient to overturn the declination. The company cannot plead ignorance of its financial obligations. The loan agreement clearly states failure to pay is an event of default. There are no exceptions. The law is clear. Thinkster is statutorily barred from receiving the economic development subsidy due to this loan default. We note that EDA did receive full and final payment on September 26th of 2023, long after the application deadline of June 30th and the EDA board's action on September 12th to decline their application. Their subsequent payment in full does not change the status of their 2023 NOL application, which was correctly declined. In conclusion, the recommendation is to uphold the EDA's board's decision to deny Thinkster's application for the 2023 Technology Business Tax Certificate Transfer Program, affirming that the denial was valid and substantial ground.
Thank you. Is there a representative of Thinkster Learning?
Yes.
Please come to the podium.
Thank you. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to present our...
Can you identify yourself, please?
My name is Rajesh Alayavali. I'm the founder and CEO of Thinkster Learning, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity here. I'm prone to speaking extempore, but given that it's a three-minute thing, I'm just going to read some text. It's easier. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to present our case here, and I'm here to respectfully appeal to your judgment regarding the declination of our NOL application by the NJEDA. Our journey with NJEDA began with a commitment to compliance and transparency. We have always strived to maintain a clear and open line of communication. When we submitted our NOL application on June 30th, it was done with the utmost care and honesty under the belief that we were not in default. Unfortunately, a notice of default reached us on July 19th, 19 days after I certified the application. We immediately engaged in proactive discussions with NJEDA personnel striving to understand and rectify the situation. Our commitment to resolving this issue was evidenced by our consistent follow-ups and an offer to repay the loan in full, despite facing communication delays. We send an email, we get no response for 3 or 4 weeks. That's been the case with NJEDA so far. I want to emphasize that our repayment have been timely and consistent. We have maintained a direct debit arrangement with NJEDA for several years. In fact, when NJEDA thinks that we have to pay some money back, they simply withdraw the money from our bank. That's the direct debit arrangement. So we don't initiate any payments. NJEDA basically say $20,000 is due, they take it from the bank account. That's been the norm. In April 2023, sensing a need for clarity in our loan status, this is a couple of months before our loan was due, proactively, I reached out to Mr. Tim Rolander and later to Mr. Kamran Hashmi of NJEDA. Their guidance led us to fruitful discussions with Ms. Elena Persico and Ms. Mansi Nayak, reflecting our continuous efforts to stay informed and compliant. Upon realizing that the default status post July 20th, we did not hesitate to act. We initiated immediate discussions with Mr. Joseph DeFranco and Ms. Kerry Lack, culminating in the full repayment of our loan on September 25th, 2023. In fact, 6 weeks prior to that, we actually reached out to NJEDA and say, what do we need to do? Is there anything due from us? And we paid off the entire $6,000. Thinkster has been a proud contributor to New Jersey economic landscape, bringing over $11 million in investments and generating more than $20 million in revenue. Our commitment to growth is unwavering, and the NOL funds are crucial for us to remain viable as an operating company. This is the truth today. If we don't get this, we shut doors, period. More importantly, even though we have paid off our loan, NJEDA remains a significant shareholder in Thinkster, as it actually warrants. It's an equity holder in Thinkster. On a personal note, I want to actually share this, right? The journey of an entrepreneur has been both rewarding and messy. Rewarding because we've been able to impact the lives of hundreds of thousands of students across the world. Messy because it is not easy to run an education technology company, because not many investors think that the future of education in this country merits their time when so many other compelling opportunities exist for making an investment. In conclusion, we believe that the sequence of events as detailed demonstrates our dedication to transparency, compliance, and proactive engagement. We request your fair and thoughtful consideration of our appeal. Your support will not only aid in our continued growth, but also contribute to the broader economic development of New Jersey. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Chairman, can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
There were Marcus's recitation, January 2022 missed payment. Can you comment on
sure.
that?
Sure. So, like I said, every payment, you've been paying the loans for the last 7 years. Every payment NJEDA has actually gotten from us has been a direct debit payment. They don't ask us. We don't tell them. They come to the account every month. It's like a mortgage payment. They just take the money out. In fact, in April of 2023, I was realizing that there was only a $5,000 debit that was going on, which was all interest. And I proactively reached out to NJEDA, which is when they actually woke up that something was happening. And so we have been looking at something happened in the COVID timeframe. I think things got lost, files got shuffled. So we have been proactive from the get-go for the last 7 years, proactively. And anytime NJEDA made a request, we have always complied with it without hesitation.
And the 2022 missed payment?
It wasn't a missed payment. I mean, they were supposed to take $19,000. They simply were taking only $5,000. We didn't know about this until I woke up and realized, like, you're just taking $5,000. But in the 6 years of payments, we have never initiated a payment. NJEDA basically says, you owe this money, we'll take this money from the bank. Because I authorized NJEDA to directly get into a bank, put their hands in, take the money out, whatever was due. So we have never prevented them from taking any money. We have never, and even as late as the May invoice of 2023, it didn't indicate any default. I have records, I have bills, I have copies, I can show it to you. There was not a single indication of defaults made by NJEDA to us until we started to proactively reach out. And we reached out 3 months ahead of our due date to say, hey, we are having some financial difficulties. Can we work something out? And when that was basically told to us that this is not possible, we said, okay, what do we do to actually make this thing whole? And as soon as somebody got back to us, we paid it.
Okay.
that part of the agreement that it would be automatic withdrawal from
yes.
monthly payments?
Yes. That's
part of the agreement.
That's what a direct agreement entails, NJEDA to do. It's an NJEDA's action and authority to actually do whatever it needs to do. We give a blanket check. It's like every month you take whatever money from our bank account that we owe to you.
And then that was for monthly payments, but then there was the balloon payment in 2022.
All of it was done exactly the same way. That's the arrangement.
It was supposed to be a direct.
Everything is a direct debit with NJEDA.
The $600,000
is the final payment, and that's when we proactively reached out in April saying, what do we need to do? And June 30th is when I filed for NOL, on which day there was no mention of default, because July 19th is when we actually got an official letter. And as soon as we got the letter, we constantly wrote back to, and I can show you emails. I mean, we write an email, get no response for 3 weeks.
Was the balloon payment supposed to be an automatic withdrawal?
Generally, it's because it's a very large amount. It's a discussion. That's why we reached out in April for the $600,000 payment, because we wanted to make sure that we can actually make that work.
When was that due, the $600,000 payment?
In July 23rd. And as soon as we got to know that NJEDA was, we're trying to work some favorable terms. Can we extend it? Can we stretch it? As soon as the minute we got to know that that's not possible, we paid off the money. We borrowed from somewhere else and we paid off the money.
So you actually paid it on the 23rd, July 23rd?
No, we actually paid it on September 25th, I think. That's when we got the notice earlier. But we have been writing back to NJEDA saying, what do we need to do? Do we need to make the payment before it even came to the board?
Tim, I guess we don't know why our withdrawals were less than the agreement at a point in time.
I don't sit here off the top of my head, no. But,
Is it possible to table this
yes.
so that we can
yes.
investigate it further and then someone will come back to the board for approval?
Yes, this is
my personal request, gentlemen, please do whatever you can under your powers to actually help us out. That's my personal request.
The issue I think we believe we have is the statutory question of a default.
I understand.
Eliminates the ability to grant the NOL. But I agree. We'll table it. We'll consider
it. The spirit of the engagement with NJEDA has never been to default. That's the only point I want to make.
Thank you for your appeal.
Thank you.
We will take it to under advice.
Do you want me to come back or stay here? What's the procedure?
No, we won't do it now.
There
we have
won't
to
be
do
a vote
after
this
the board.
Time. Then
yeah.
staff will reach out to let you know at what point there would be a vote or what will happen next.
I really appreciate your time, gentlemen. And I do want to make a comment that the staff of NJEDA have been nothing but extraordinarily professional and exceptional in the dealings with us. I do want to comment on that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, a motion table is good. Or is that just
We can just table. I mean, unless any board member has any objection, just table it.
I assume no one has an objection to tabling the item.
No.
No one on the phone. All right, thank you. Next, we're going to go Caitlin on Cornerstone Pharmaceuticals.
This matter is an appeal of the declination of Cornerstone Pharmaceuticals' application for the 2023 NOL program. Following thorough review of the record, I'm recommending that the declination be upheld, as the applicant did not meet the definition of new and expanding under the program rules. To qualify for the NOL program, an applicant must first meet the definition of a technology or biotechnology business, second, have unused amounts of research and development tax credits and/or unused net operating loss carryover, and third, meet the definition of new and expanding. On September 28, 2023, the authority's board declined Cornerstone's application on the basis that the company did not meet the definition of new and expanding, as it did not show at least 10 full-time employees working in New Jersey. The company's application stated that it employed exactly 10 full-time employees. One of the 10 employees was Sanjeev Luther, the company's CEO, who lives in Delaware. Under the program rules, a full-time employee working in this state is defined in relevant part as a full-time employee whose primary office is in New Jersey and who spends at least 80% of his or her time in New Jersey. EDA requested confirmation that Mr. Luther spends at least 80% of his time in New Jersey, as well as evidence demonstrating same. Mr. Luther replied stating that per the company's hybrid work schedule, their New Jersey office is only open 3 days per week,
and provided EasyPass statements which indicated that Mr. Luther worked at the New Jersey office on an average of 1 to 2 days per week. Accordingly, on September 28, 2023, the authority's board declined the application on the basis that the company did not meet the definition of new and expanding, as NJEDA could not sufficiently verify that Mr. Luther met the definition of full-time employee working in the state as defined by the program rules. Without Mr. Luther, they did not have 10 full-time employees working in the state to fulfill the program requirement. On appeal, Cornerstone Pharmaceuticals argues that the authority's board erred in denying its program application because its hybrid work schedule requires employees to work only 3 days per week in the office, and Mr. Luther spends all three of those days, or roughly 24 hours per week, in the New Jersey office. The company argues that Mr. Luther should be required to spend only 80% of those 24 hours per week in the New Jersey office. Under that interpretation, Mr. Luther would be required to spend only 19.2 hours per week in the New Jersey office, which he claims to satisfy. Essentially, the company contends that the requirement should be modified to accommodate its hybrid work schedule. These arguments are unpersuasive. Firstly, 80% of a 3-day work week does not satisfy the required minimum of 80% of a full-time 35-hour work week as required by the statute and rules. A company's hybrid work schedule cannot modify the statutory requirement. Also, the company's concession on appeal that their New Jersey office is only open 3 out of 5 days per week demonstrates that Mr. Luther works in New Jersey no more than 60% of the week. As such, I've concluded that the authority's board has demonstrated a sufficient basis for the decision to decline the application and recommend that the board decision be upheld.
Okay, thank you. Is there a representative of Cornerstone who wishes to speak?
Yes. Thank you, first of all, for the opportunity. I'm the CEO of Cornerstone, and my name is Sanjeev Luther. Very quickly, the company has been around in New Jersey for about 20 years, and it works on cutting-edge cancer therapies, for example, patients who could only survive for 30 days. We run one of the largest compassionate use programs in the state of New Jersey for pancreatic cancer, so it does cost the company a lot of money to do it, all this stuff. This has been a little bit of a surprise to us because this application was actually approved first, and then somehow subsequently was declined. So I do have some new information because when, as you presented, that actually I do, based on the EasyPass records, which we submitted and I have with me, I'm actually spending 19.88 hours, which is 80% of the 3 days. You all know that most of the pharmaceutical companies in the state of New Jersey, actually in entire U.S., are actually 2 days they open right now, not actually 3 days. Cornerstone in 2022 changed to go to 3 days. So we are one of the very few pharmaceutical companies who actually operate 3 days. In fact, there's an article for you from Sanofi, which is one of the largest employers here, 2 days. They actually have. So my appeal to you is, first of all, that based on the EasyPass requirements, I mean 19.88, not 19.2, actually. So not 60%, actually more than 80%. If the company is not physically open 3 days, I can't enter the company. I'm not just any employee. I'm a CEO of this company. To keep this company afloat, I have to go raise money other places. And we run trials globally, not just in New Jersey, right? So just not any part-time employee, CEO of a company who's running this company. Company is physically closed 2 days. Every other employee only comes to the company 3 days a week too. Let me also tell you, in my 9 years since I've been the CEO of this company, I have put 500,000 miles on three of my cars to come every day when the company was open 5 days, to come every day when the company was open 3 days, right? I have put from my own pocket hundreds of thousands of dollars to pay EasyPass money, which is a record I've submitted. So it's not like I'm sitting at home and working and not showing up. So my request to you is we do meet the requirement of 80% of the time required because according to these records, which I'll give it to you, 19.88, not 19.2. Number two, none of the pharmaceutical companies right now in New Jersey are actually open more than 2.5 days. The only company which has gone to 2.5 days is actually Pfizer, Bristol-Myers Squibb, J&J, Sanofi, which are larger, way larger companies than us. The other thing is, due to the economic downturn and COVID and some setback the company has had in one of our clinical programs, the company has invested about $400 million. In state of New Jersey, $400 million. We don't get this money, $4.5 million, this year because the company has always gotten this credit over the last 3 years.
And this money was included in the budget of this company going forward. If we don't get this money, it's an emotional appeal. Take it, leave it. This company will be shuttered. And all this work we are doing will go to total waste because we are on the cusp of doing a drug to cure pancreatic cancer, which no other company is working on. And I've given my 9 years of my life. I actually spent between me and you can find from anybody in the company, almost 92, 80 hours a week I work, whether I'm physically in the office or not. So as a CEO of the company, I could easily travel business class. I only travel economy class across the globe. So my request to you is, number two, one is that we do meet the requirement, and the math is there. You can check it again. No problems. Company is only physically open 3 days. In fact, it's the only company in New Jersey right now in pharmaceutical industry which is actually open 3 days. So thank you for your time, and I would hope you would let us continue to do this wonderful research we are doing to save many patients across the globe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for that presentation, sir, and thank you for your investments in New Jersey and the work you're doing with cure cancer. All of it is wonderful. A reasonable person could conclude that the statute is outdated and immodern with regard to hybrid work. And for employees who live in New Jersey and are hybrid working, they're okay. Their statute is unfortunately pretty unambiguous. Again, a reasonable person could argue that the statute should probably be refreshed and updated, but it hasn't. That's my perspective. That is relevant.
So you're saying it's based on essentially a 5-day work week.
Statute. It's based on a 5-day in-person work weekend.
Jewel here. I have a question for the group. During COVID, were any of the statutes modified during that time? Just curious.
Some were modified. This one was not. There was a blanket waiver of all these in-person requirements during the peak of COVID. There was various timetables, but during the peak of COVID, when there were accommodations and waivers.
I believe for this program, there might have been 2 years where this was waived, but under executive order, so the statute and the rules did not change.
Correct. Thank you.
Do you have a question, Charles?
Yes, Chair. So is the decline in the application also based on the new or expanding technology aspect of the statute? Because it's in here, but it's not too much, I guess, justification or position. I didn't hear from the CFO of the applicant, nor did I really read it here, but it's listed as being another reason. I'm just wondering if that's on the table also.
If you want, I'll jump in. It's because the rules stack upon themselves, so it goes down to there's a definition for full-time employees, and then, so if we're saying to be considered a new and expanding company, you also then have to meet what the full-time employee one is. So it's you don't meet the new technology definition because of not meeting the full-time employee definition.
You need to have a certain number of jobs to be a new or expanding company. So it's really all one declination, but because you don't have the full-time employees, therefore you're not a new or expanding company.
Yeah. Can I just add something to it? I am a full-time employee,
sir,
and the
sir.
Second part which you are mentioning...
Sir, there's only one opportunity.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
Okay,
sorry. I guess any further questions or comments? Anyone on the phone? So we will take a vote to... I guess the vote should be to approve the recommendation of the hearing officer. Could I hear a motion to approve?
Dragon, motion to approve.
Second. Anyone to second?
Second, Elijah.
Thank you. All right, so we're voting on, just to be clear, we're voting on a motion to approve the recommendation of the hearing officer to decline the appeal. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any recusals or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes.
Hearing enough eyes on that.
Can we hear enough eyes on that? Make sure everybody's on. Good vote one way or the
other, please.
You want us to do a roll call vote?
Yes.
All right, roll call vote. Manier, please.
Okay.
Terrence O'Toole.
Aye.
Charles Sarlo.
Aye.
Phil Elagia.
Yes.
Robert Shimko.
Yes.
Jewel Antoine Johnson.
Yes.
Fred Dumont?
Here. Yes, and yeah, I'm sorry, yes.
Marcia Marley?
Yes.
Is that a yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Aaron Cruz?
Yes.
Justin Zimmerman?
Yes.
Keith White?
Yes.
Elizabeth Dragon?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. The motion passes. Okay, we're now going to move to the Audit Committee report. I'll give a brief overview. The Audit Committee met on November 30th. Staff presented the Audit Committee with the 2022 annual report and the 2022 audited financials for the committee's review and approval to come to the board today. Members will note that this report is more than 150 pages long and includes a bounty of information about the work done here at the authority. And I will note we are approving it at the end of 2023 for 2022.
2024.
It is. Staff also presented the committee with the 2024 proposed fiscal plan, which was included and we'll have a brief presentation on today. Following these presentations, staff approved updates on various items, including external audits underway, integrity oversight monitor updates, compliance audits, and the quarterly portfolio review and risk reports. First up, Virginia Flood on the annual report.
Just real quickly to the chairman's point about just barely still 2023, this is the 2022 report. This is one of the sort of the last hangovers we're resolving from COVID time. We got behind on our financial close. The audit took some time to get completed, and so we will have the 2023 annual report earlier in the year in 2024. But we're not in overtime on meeting closures here.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you the 2022 NJEDA Annual Report. Before you, you will find the narrative portion of the report, which highlights the NJEDA's many achievements and milestones reached throughout 2022, all under the thoughtful expert guidance of this board. The report includes many examples of businesses and nonprofits, entrepreneurs, and communities that have leveraged NJEDA resources to grow their businesses, create jobs, revitalize their communities, and improve quality of life for New Jerseyans. Beginning in 2006, to meet the requirements of Executive Order No. 37, the narrative annual report has been combined with the authority's audited financial statements and serves as the NJEDA's comprehensive annual report. The report can be viewed in its entirety via a link provided in Convene or the link provided in an email sent prior to this meeting. The audited financial statements for the year ending December 31, 2022 were prepared pursuant to generally accepted accounting principles for a government entity. I am pleased to inform the board that the independent accounting firm of PKF O'Connor Davies, LLP, has issued an unmodified opinion regarding the 2022 financial statements. On November 30, 2023, per its charter, the Audit Committee reviewed the 2022 audited financial statements and considered the relevancy, accuracy, and completeness of the information presented. The independent auditor met with the Audit Committee, where it was reported that the financial audit resulted in no negative findings or internal control deficiencies. Under Executive Order No. 37, mentioned previously, the authority is required to obtain approval of its comprehensive annual report from its board of directors. Upon approval, the report will be submitted to the authority's unit, posted to the NJEDA's website, and transmitted electronically to members of the legislature. Authority staff has prepared the comprehensive annual report for 2022 as required under Executive Order No. 37 and recommends members' approval. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your consideration.
Any questions, comments? Anyone on the phone? Can I hear a motion to approve the annual report and the financial statements?
So moved.
Thank you. Second.
Antoine, second.
Great. Thank you, Jewel. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, refusals, or abstentions? None being heard, the motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Virginia. Rich?
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the board.
Just regrettably note that it is, in fact,
I was going
now
to say, I'm going to say good morning.
It is now the afternoon.
Wow.
So you have before you today the proposed 2024 EDA fiscal plan. It continues to be the result of a collaborative effort between senior EDA staff and senior management. It meets the two-fold objective of the authority, which is to support businesses, as we see here every month when we come to these meetings, and to advance a fiscally responsible and financially sustainable platform. And we think we've met both of those objectives. The plan for this year projects operating revenues and other cash infusions to exceed the 2023 plan. On a consolidated basis, our revenues have now surpassed pre-COVID. We had that dip while we were doing some of the emergency response efforts. And now you've seen this borne out with Aspire and Film and some of the new products that we have. Of course, interest rates are helping us as well on our idle cash. You have an internal NOE of just over $10 million. We say internal because that carves out the non-cash things like depreciation expense and loss provision. So it's a non-GAAP fiscal plan. The fiscal plan was reviewed by the chairman and the members of the audit committee at their meeting on November 30th, and they recommended that to the board today. And we are asking for your approval accordingly for the 24 plan. And Tim, anything to add?
The only thing I'd add is, as Rich noted, the revenue picture continues to be both balanced and strong, and balanced by strong contributors on lots of different fronts. Obviously, Federal Reserve and their interest rate policy has helped us quite a bit this year, but as has a return to sort of normalcy of program revenues and getting paid for our work and administering various appropriations and all those things. The positive year we're going to have in 23 and projected to have in 24 kind of offsets and replenishes some pretty challenging years in 20, 21, 22, where we were kind of in an investment mode and now getting back to, having, again, as Rich consistently reminds us, have to have revenues to match our expenses. Good business 101, but Rich has to remind me all the same. I think the picture here is strong. The balance sheet is, as the chairman has noted, the balance sheet is a fortress. The balance sheet is arguably quite under-levered. There's just nothing. If this was a private company, you'd buy back debt, you'd buy back shares, you'd do a dividend. We don't do those things because we're for the public sector here. Preserving the fortress nature of that balance sheet is fruit.
Remind me again of what was the assumption we made about interest rates in 2024?
Coming in a little bit.
So we have a twofold component there. A lot of the money is invested in the state's cash management fund, as most government agencies are, and that is running now somewhere between 5.25% and 5.5%. And then we have an investment portfolio, so we kind of hedge when times aren't as favorable, and you've got laddered investments there in treasuries and agencies and commercial paper. But when we looked at the cash management fund, and now we have a bulk of the money in there, A, because we need liquidity to get money out the door for all the initiatives, but we also built in there three reductions in 2024. And as you may have heard the Fed say yesterday, that may happen, but we've built that in as if it were to start day one. Obviously, that may happen over the course of the year. And typically, that passive interest income, we budget conservatively, and we end up over budget. And
so you correctly predicted the Fed?
Well,
I haven't.
What do I do?
You know,
Rich said, Jay, I'd do three.
We, you know, to use a sports analogy, we don't like to take points off the board. So we'd rather budget it conservatively.
Sure.
If it comes in better, and typically it does. And you could see that borne out in 2023 as well. We did a lot better than what we planned.
The other issue will be when, you know, sort of cash disbursements go out.
Right,
because right now we have a lot of cash.
That's correct.
But that's also forecasted quite conservatively because that doesn't include the appropriations we will receive toward the end of this fiscal year, and that also assumes we never receive another dollar appropriated cash from the legislature, which I got the budget chair's brother. Hopefully that doesn't come to pass, but
right.
we're built for that.
So even though the state's fiscal year starts, FY24 started on July 1st, we won't see that money until probably June 30th of 2024. So we, as Tim said, beyond whatever else you be doing beyond that.
Any other questions? Anyone on the phone, questions or comments? So we need, the motion is to approve the 2024 budget or fiscal plan. Any other motion to approve?
Robert Shimko.
Thank you. Second?
I second. Antoine.
Thank you, Jewel. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
I don't know how you can have a recusal or abstention, but any? None?
All right. The motion passes. Thanks, Rich.
All right.
Next, maybe with a paid board, it could be like, you know, there's not nothing there for paying the board. This volunteer crew, I don't think, has that ground.
All right, the next is Jingasa on the independent compliance request.
I want you to notice that all the lawyers are wearing maroon and purple today. If you look very carefully. So this is, we are asking for approval to enter into a contract with Mercadian for compliance audit services and for risk assessment. Under the Economic Recovery Act, we're required to do periodic systematic audits of our incentive program. We've done this previously through a Treasury contract, which has expired, so the EDA did its own procurement. On July 28th, we advertised an RFP duly in three newspapers on our website, and we received 8 proposals at a public bid opening. 4 of those proposals were responsive. The 4 proposals were reviewed and evaluated by an evaluation committee. We scored the proposals technically. Then procurement reviewed the cost proposals, combined the price and non-price factors, and ranked the 4 responsive proposals. Mercadian was ranked the highest. We issued a best and final offer to Mercadian. They reduced the cost to about $27,000 per audit for the EDA. The RFP is different this time because we've also incorporated audits for the commission, for CSIT, our partner agency, and the price for the CSIT audits are about $26,000, and the risk assessment cost is $63,524. So we are asking you to approve a contract for 5 years, base period of 3 years, 2 1-year option periods. The total amount is not to exceed $1,669,084. The portion to EBA alone is $1.15 million. The portion for CSIT is approximately $500,000. We will amend our MOU with CSIT to reimburse us for that portion. And so based on that, we're asking for approval to enter this contract with Mercadian.
Is Mercadian the current vendor?
It is.
There's a bit of atmospheric. Even if the Economic Recovery Act did not require us to do this, we could we would do this or something like it because we just took a position that we were going to be tougher on ourselves than anybody else ever could be on the outside. You know, you say that and then somebody comes along and gets tougher than we figured out it'd be, but you never know. But we put ourselves in the ringer purposefully. Not with huge internal approval ratings for that approach, but this has proven, I think, to be a very, very helpful both peace of mind and identifying a handful of issues along the way as we go.
Any questions, comments? Excuse me. Hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
Robert Chimkin.
Thank you, Robert. Any second, please?
Antoine, second.
Jewel, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? The motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Christine, on delegations of authority.
Good afternoon. Over the past 20 months, we have revamped delegations of authority at the recommendation of a board governance consultant in an effort to improve overall board functionality. The overarching goal was to have the board delegate more authority to staff for routine matters such as individual applications, contracts, and other transactions. The board has approved a series of revisions to existing delegations of authority as well as some new ones. Among others, last June, the board approved increasing the threshold for procured contracts so that the CEO or his delegate could approve contracts up to $500,000. Concurrently, the board approved delegated authority for memoranda of understanding and other intergovernmental agreements up to that same threshold. In the 18 months since then, staff has been able to approve 30 MOUs and 9 procured contracts that previously would have had to come to the board for approval. Yet board approval was still required for another 32 MOUs and 8 procured contracts, meaning we still have a lot of stuff coming to the board, a lot of transaction-level decisions. So at this point, what we're recommending is that the board increase the threshold from the $500,000 approved last June up to $1 million. As always, the proposed delegations were reviewed by the Attorney General's office and discussed in committee. And I'm going to keep it short because you still have a few items on the agenda, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Anyone on the board? Questions? Comments? So the motion is to raise the limit from 500 to a million.
Correct.
Okay. Hearing no further questions, can I have a motion to approve?
Motion, Cruz.
Thank you. Second.
Second, Zimmerman.
That's why I'm second.
Thank you.
With more delegation, fewer votes, fewer seconds, which would be next.
All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Recusals or abstentions, hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
David Lawler and Michael Dealey on delegation for environmental programs.
Thank you. I'm going to go first with the request for the DEP program's delegated authority. So we're asking members to approve an increased delegated authority for the Petroleum Underground Storage Tank Fund and the Hazardous Discharge Site Remediation Fund program to the maximum amount available under current legislation. So currently the existing delegated authority is $1.5 million, and that's for initial and supplemental approvals for both programs. The maximum amount currently available as per legislation under the HDSRF program is $3 million for all eligible public entity applicants. And those are ones that do not have a brownfield development area project designation within their municipal or county boundaries. It's $5 million for all eligible public entity applicants that do have this type of project designation, which is more commonly referred to as a BDA. The application process for the HDSRF program begins with NJDEP staff, and a central role in NJDEP's review is determining if the grant proposal and costs follow DEP regulations, which are spelled out in the technical requirements for site remediation. These requirements are prescriptive, and compliance is determined solely by NJDEP. The amount of the grant request is representative of the type of remediation work that is required by NJDEP. So regarding the POSP fund, the maximum amount available to applicants is $3 million, and the application process also begins with DEP, funding provided through this program is in accordance with both the UST fund statutory guidelines as well as NJDEP remediation requirements. So the NJEDA staff, we do not participate in negotiation of the work or the amount of the grant intended to complete the remediation. NJDEP takes the lead role in this negotiation. Supplemental funding requests represent continued support by DEP and EDA for projects that are already in the remediation process. So EDA does take the lead role in evaluating administrative components of the application as well as redevelopment requirements and ownership requirements. We initiate approval notifications, execute grant agreements, and provide disbursement of funds for these ongoing projects. So finally, the universe of the HDSRF applications that have been presented to the board since the increase in delegated authority of $1.5 million represent established budgets that have been accepted and approved by DEP, and this increase in delegated authority would not change the EDA process or complexity of the review. I'll take any questions.
Is this one motion, or?
I think I'm going to go first, sorry, and then Dave is going to go second.
Yeah, so. And then it's one vote for the entire.
Presentation of this memo.
Yes.
Thank you, Mike.
Yep.
Similar to the grant delegation, we also request increased delegation to approve loan applications under the UST and HD programs up to the maximum amounts available under statutory legislation. The justification is the credit analysis completed for a loan under DEP programs is the same as the analysis performed for a loan request under our business banking loan programs to which we do have current approval delegations. For many years, EDA staff has underwritten loans under the authority's numerous programs and as a result has fully developed a specialized skill set of credit analysis. Finally, delegated authority is requested that for declines issued by staff under our business banking loan and DEP grant and loan programs, we have authority to issue final administrative decisions if applicants appeal those declinations. Any decline issued by staff under these programs are non-discretionary and based on the applicant not meeting a board-specified criteria or a requirement under program statute. Appeals must be submitted within the time frame set in a decline letter, and should a declination be upheld, the applicant will have the right to appeal to the Appellate Division of Superior Court of New Jersey. Justification for this request is that the EDA has already has authority to decline requests that do not meet program requirements, and this request is consistent with recent delegations approved by the board for how decline appeals are handled.
Could you just remind us of what the current levels are and what we're recommending they go to?
Yes, so under loans, the current levels that we have under the HD loans, it is $500,000 per calendar year. And for UST, public entities can receive $3 million in loans per calendar year, plus an additional $2 million for remediation in a brownfield development area. The maximum amount may be up to $3 million if the site is located in a state policy map planning area, or if the remediation is to address a discharge that poses a threat to drinking water. That's our current delegations for DEP. Would you like to know our current delegations for business banking loan programs?
No, that's okay. So what are we recommending they go to?
We're recommending that we can approve any amount as allowed under legislation.
And what are those? Are there legislative caps?
Yes. Right now, it's a $500,000 per calendar year, and the amounts that I just mentioned. But at some point in the future, if they were increased, we can go up to that new amount.
By legislation. Okay. Any further questions? Comments? Hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
Dragon motion.
Second?
That's 1 second.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you.
I'm still here.
Okay, one more. Go ahead.
Quick one.
Marcia's got a quick point.
Sorry. Marcia, do you want to give a Director's Loan Review Committee report?
Yes, it will be very short. The New Jersey EDA Director's Loan Review Committee met on November 29th. Staff presented one memo regarding defeasance and reduction of certain outstanding NJDA school facilities construction bonds. The memo is a time-sensitive request so that the bonds can be removed from the state debt portfolio as soon as possible. Turning it back over to you.
Thank you, Marcia. Okay, so David, now you're going to do the defeasance and redemption of certain construction bonds.
Yes, thank you. So the members of the authority are asked to approve a resolution allowing the EDA to enter into one or more escrow deposit agreements for the purpose of defeasing and redeeming all or a portion of the 2016 Series AAA school construction bonds. The state within its general fund maintains a restrictive reserve account for the purpose of defeasing debts of the state. The legislation creating the fund leaves the selection of bonds up to the state treasurer. The treasurer has directed Office of Public Finance to choose which bonds present the best savings. In this transaction, Treasury will take approximately $75 million in cash from the fund, place the proceeds into escrow, and use those same monies to make the scheduled payments on a portion of the outstanding AAA school construction school facility bond up to its early call date in December of 26. Once the call date has been reached, that same portion of the outstanding balance will be paid off using the deposit from the state plus any interest earned in the escrow account. Since the cash to make the future payments and pay off a portion of the outstanding bond will be set aside in escrow, the state, soon after board approval, will be able to remove that portion of the obligation from its balance sheet. As with past defeasances, the goal is to lower the state's overall debt levels and save taxpayer money by retiring bonds early, which eliminates future interest payments. This particular transaction will save $38.7 million of interest payments. At the end of this calendar year, across the entire defeasance program of the state, about $1.35 billion in future interest payments will be saved. Credit rating agencies also view the defeasance of debt as a positive impact on the state's public debt rating.
And in fact, we have been asked by the Treasury Department to do this.
Correct.
Any further questions, comments? Hearing none, could I have a motion to approve? Thank you. Second.
Second, Elijah.
Thank you, Bill. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Antoine, I recuse myself from this. Antoine.
Jewel, recusing.
Yes.
Can you state the reason for the record?
We have a few opportunities, educational construction opportunities, and I'm not knowing how that is affected, I just refuse.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Joel.
Thanks, Joel.
Noted. All right, Juan, on real estate.
Well, I will formally beg to recognize that brevity is the soul of wit. Very efficient here.
We have four procurements that we're requesting amendments to their contract amendments. It's two memos. I'll cover them together. The first one is the JLL contract amendment. We're requesting to add $471,330,000 to the real estate advisory services contract. The members approved that contract in April of 23 and initially authorized $1.7 million in funds, and it was split in two pots, $950,000 for real estate, $750,000 for my colleague, Babor, to use in credit underwriting. The contract is managed so the funds are independent, so we have to seek amendments separately. We can't swap the funds. So next year we anticipate issuing about $1.38 million in change orders. And with the current balance we have in the account, minus the $41,330 that we've already spent, we need about $471,330 added to that account to manage that contract. Now, there's three pooled services contracts that we need amended. We need to add $300,000 to the appraisal services contract, increasing it to $1.1 million, add approximately $5.65 million to the environmental services pooled contract, bringing that amount to about $6.05 million, and adding $400,000 to the survey contract to a new total of $800,000. The appraisal was approved by the board in January 2021, and it was for $300,000. We've issued about $46,000 of task orders. We need about $200,000 in a new balance, and the new balance after we spend about $54,000. We're requesting to add $300,000 to that contract, and also requesting that the CEO can add another $500,000 if required. The environmental service pool is probably the most complicated of all this, is that that was a pool for $400,000, and we're requesting to add $5.65 million to that contract, and that's in particular to one task order to one firm related to the health and agriculture. In addition to the $5.65 million, we're asking that the CEO can add $500,000 to that procurement. In particular, there's about $4.5 million that is allocated as a worst-case scenario to Montrose Environmental, who is the licensed site remediation professional for the health and agriculture remediation and demolition project. The LSRP will be handling the disposal of the remaining contaminated crushed aggregate on the site because the construction manager cannot do it because he does not have the appropriate license to remove the aggregate. This will include everything from contracting with the vendors and the additional work is going to be paid for with state government building bonds that the members already approved to complete the health and agriculture remediation in June 2024. The last one is in 10-22, the board approved the pool for survey. We have issued, for $400,000, we've issued about $30,000 of change orders. We believe we're going to have we've issued $279,000 in task orders. We need $400,000 for new tasks, and so we're asking to add another $400,000 to the contract, leaving the balance. In addition, for the pool services only, we're requesting that Tim, the CEO, can amend each contract in the pool up to the amount approved by this board for each pool and increase each pool by an additional $500,000 if required. There's only one minor note. The exhibit attached to the second board memo, Exhibit A, I'm going to delete any reference to real estate advisory services because that's addressed in the first board memo and it shouldn't be in there. Any questions? That is correct.
Yes, a contaminant in the brick that no one knew was there, and there's a dispute about who.
Yes, correct.
Going to pay for that.
I don't know if it's appropriate for open session. We've dealt with that before, so there is a pending cleanup for that, and there's funds available for it, and this LSRP is not the original contractor engaged, and we engaged them from this pool, so we need to increase his contract to finish this work.
So that, I mean, that's the biggest.
That is correct. That's where all the money is going.
Okay. Any questions? Anyone on the board? Questions, comments? Hearing none, are we voting on, are there two motions here?
All right, so we're going to vote on the first one, which is the amendment to the Jones Lang Real Estate Advisory Consulting Services contract. Do I hear a motion to approve? Charles, I'm going to consider you a second.
Sure.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Recusals or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, motion passes. And then secondly, a motion to approve the funding increases as presented to the pooled consulting services. Can I hear a motion to approve?
Motion.
Thank you. Second.
All those in favor,
Charles seconded, we'll consider that. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye. Opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes. Tim, board memoranda.
With deep respect for the board's time, I'm going to assume you will have the opportunity to read the memos at your convenience and know where to find me if you have any questions.
You're ceding your time back.
Yeah, I'm going to yield the balance.
To the gentleman from Milburn.
Exactly.
All right.
We do have an executive session.
Yes, I know.
No vote, but we do have an executive session discussion. So.
I would now like to open the public comment portion of the meeting. First, I'd like to ask Danielle Esser to read the NJEDA's public comment policy and process for this board meeting.
Thank you. As stated in the NJEDA's public comment policy on the website, members who wish public who wish to speak during the public comment period will be acknowledged to speak first in person, then by phone. Members attending the public meeting by phone can press 1 and 0 on the keypad, and you will be registered to speak in the order in which your request is received. Each speaker will speak one at a time. Each speaker should announce his or her name, organization, affiliation, and the topic on which remarks will be given. Each speaker has a maximum of 3 minutes to speak and should limit their comments to matters pertaining to the authority. Staff will prompt the speaker once their time has expired. A person may speak once during the public comment period and may submit any documents in printed form or via email. Thank you.
Okay, I will now acknowledge members who wish to provide public comments at this time. Anyone in the room?
These good people all work for us, so this is not the time.
Operator, did you ask if there's anyone on the line?
Ladies and gentlemen, for members of the public on the phone, if you wish to ask a question, please press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, you may press 1 and then 0 at this time. One moment for our first question. And, Sir Chair, we have no questions in queue. Please continue.
Thank you, Operator. With no additional comments, I'd like to thank everyone for their participation today. I would now like to request a motion to enter executive session to discuss potential negotiations regarding a real estate matter where disclosure could adversely impact the public interest, the minutes of which will become available when the need for confidentiality no longer exists. Could I hear a motion to approve moving to executive session?
Motion.
Thank you. Second?
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposals, recusals, or abstentions? None being heard, we will now enter executive session.
Thank you. The board will now enter executive session. For members on the public, please continue to hold your board members.
Tara, Mary,
once the line of
executive other members of the commission are welcome to stay, but also welcome to go to lunch. Not